In Depth with Francis Rose on Federal News Radio, 1500 AM. Usable news and information for your job. And now, here's Francis Rose.
Welcome to the program for Thursday, September 23rd, 2010, on Federal News Radio, 1500 AM. And a word of warning as we get the Thursday program started. Tomorrow will be the best of In Depth with Francis Rose as my son Francis and I make our way to Delaware. We're going to be taking in the NASCAR race at Dover International Speedway over the weekend. And so the best of In-Depth will be on tomorrow, and I'll be back on Monday with a brand new show. In hour number two of the program, we're going to look at diversity in hiring in the federal government with officials from the Office of Personnel Management, the Environmental Protection Agency, and the Department of Homeland Security, and finding out how they are meeting the challenge of bringing a diverse workforce into the federal government. In hour number one, as we always do on Thursdays on In-Depth with Francis Rose, it's Industry Chatter, and today I'm happy to welcome to the program Jim Champy, who is Chairman Emeritus of Dell Services Consulting. Jim, it's great to see you and have you in the studio.
Thank you, Francis. It's good to join you today.
In addition to working with an extensive number of government clients for Dell and Perot before that, you're also the author or co-author of this new book called Reengineering Healthcare, A Manifesto for Radically Rethinking Healthcare Delivery. And we'll talk about that. But what I think you're the first industry person who's done a lot of work with the federal government that is a multi-New York Times best-selling author. What is it inside you, in addition to what you're doing, that makes you want to sit down and write a book-length treatment on any particular topic, not just this one?
You know, Francis, I've always enjoyed and I think been privileged by being able to work inside fine organizations, whether they be companies or government agencies and places. And I've always believed that those places are, you know, are good places to be because the quality of the work that they, you know, that they produce. And so back, you know, 20-odd years ago, Mike Hammer and I, my co-author of the original Reengineering the Corporation book, the book that you referred to as a bestseller, sat back and said, look, in order to make enterprises really what they can be, we've got to start fundamentally rethinking the nature of work.
Mm-hmm.
And we've got to make work not only more efficient from a, you know, from a company and shareholder point of view, but we've got to make work more enjoyable from the individual's point of view so that they come to work with a sense of purpose and a sense of engagement. And, you know, we started to see in the late 1980s how work had become overly fragmented, overly specialized, overly bureaucratic, and, mm-hmm. and how organizations had become stovepiped in the way they operated. And we argued that it was time to, you know, just clear the decks and to fundamentally rethink the nature of work. And to give you an example from that first book, we found an insurance company, you know, that was taking 24 days to issue a simple insurance policy and a one-page invoice. And we looked at how much real work was spent during that 24-day period, and it was 10 minutes of real work.
Mm-hmm.
And the work had to go through 14 different departments. And we saw that repeated, you know. At the same time, by the way, we saw Toyota, who sometimes now criticized about their quality programs. We saw Toyota doing the same work that Ford was doing in 10% of the time with mm-hmm. higher quality.
Yeah.
And so we saw the opportunity to fundamentally rethink the nature of work. And that's what we argued in that New York Times bestseller. Mm-hmm. And by the way, I think we're only partway there in our organizations and our institutions. The good news is, today, we have a technology. We've got the internet. We've got a technology infrastructure to enable us to do work in fundamentally different ways that we didn't have 20 years ago. So I'm actually more excited about the prospect of changing the nature of work today mm-hmm. than I was 20 years ago when we wrote the original book.
Yeah. Changing the nature of an enterprise is as much mental as it is technological and as it is anything else. What are you finding that the successful people that are changing environments, that are changing work environments or any kind of structure, are doing to get people to buy into the change? Because people don't like change.
Sure,
everybody
sure,
knows
sure.
that.
Look, change is driven by a combination of fear and vision. And there are some people who try to drive change through fear. I think the real successful people actually have a sense of, you know, what I call of, and may sound like an abstract term, but the future state. Where's this organization got to go?
Mm-hmm.
At the same time, you do have to understand what's driving you in that direction. Certainly in healthcare, there are a lot of forces now driving the need for radical change. And that's why, again, I wanted to write this particular book.
Mm-hmm.
But, you know, successful people who manage organizations to bring about change, have a sense of where they're going. They're very good, by the way, in execution.
Mm-hmm.
You don't get from A to B without really knowing how to execute. But they also, Francis, move very quickly to actually change the work, There's a great debate in behavioral sciences as to whether you change the way people think first and then change what they do, or you change what they do, which changes how they think.
Mm-hmm.
Over the last 20 years, I've become a strong believer in the latter.
Mm-hmm.
You change the nature of work and get people to experience and understand that the quality of work can get better, the customer or the patient's condition can improve, that costs can go down. It can all happen at once. And again, I'm starting to see that happen in some healthcare organizations. You know, we have this new, I call it model of healthcare delivery, the storefront clinic. You
mm-hmm.
see it in an enterprise now called Minute Clinic that's owned by CVS. Walgreens has one. Many of the pharmacies have these walk-in clinics.
Yep.
Well, Francis, that was initially resisted by the physicians. They said it was unsafe, mm-hmm. unsafe to have a nurse practitioner, you know, doling out medications. Well, they have nurse practitioners in their own offices, physicians do. And with some proof that disaster hasn't happened,
mm-hmm.
and we could get costs down, and that the patients could be better served, I'm starting to see these business models being adopted and,
mm-hmm.
and at least welcomed. But it takes proof.
You talked about the fear versus vision, and
yes.
I wonder if the economic times that we're in, not just mm-hmm. in government and the potential for budget crunches in government, but just across all elements of the economy, isn't pushing people more toward the fear than the vision.
And
I don't know how good that is.
You're absolutely right, and I am concerned about that. But it's a reality. There should be fear right now. I mean, what's happening in healthcare in particular is we are seeing, and you can see hospitals already anticipating the reduction in Medicare and Medicaid payments, dramatic reductions. And so what the fear is bringing about is the downsizing of hospital staffs.
Mm-hmm.
You've seen in the news already 300 or 400 people being laid off in a hospital organization.
Mm-hmm.
And the danger there, Francis, is that those people are laid off before the work is redesigned. You know, that the few hundred people who are left or the 1,000 people who are left in a hospital now have to figure out how to do the same work that a 1,300-person staff had done.
Yeah.
And typically the result of that is a degradation of service. The quality gets reduced until, by the way, the people who are left figure out how to do the work differently.
Yeah.
And that's not the way I like to bring about operating change.
Sure.
I would much rather have the physician leaders of a hospital say, look, we have to create a better experience for our patients.
Mm-hmm.
We have to get the quality numbers up here. You know, we have to get the medical errors here down. So let's envision what that would look like and how we would have to operate to do that. That's a much more inspired way of operating. And what I'm hopeful for, Francis, in this time, is that, yeah, we're going to be operating with fear. That's a reality, and that is going to be driving a lot of change. I'm hoping we'll see some inspiration come out of delivery organizations.
We'll talk about inspiration and innovation over the course of the hour. It's a topic that you've talked about publicly a number of times. My guest is Jim Champy, co-author of the book Reengineering Healthcare, along with Dr. Harry Greenspun, my guest for the hour on In Depth with Francis Rose on Federal News Radio, 1500 AM. Back in a moment. We're back on In Depth with Francis Rose on Federal News Radio, 1500 AM. My guest is Jim Champy, one of the co-authors of the book Reengineering Healthcare, a manifesto for radically rethinking healthcare delivery. And you've worked with agencies all across the federal government over the years with Perot and with Dell. And as agencies find out more and more what the implications for them are on healthcare, a lot of them in areas that you wouldn't think of because there are a lot of agencies that have a role in it that aren't necessarily providers or
sure.
or whatever. What do you think we should be paying attention to as people who watch government operations and people who are in the business of government when it comes to the broader discussion about healthcare?
You know, Francis, I think the most important thing for people who are in these agencies, the leaders as well as the folks setting policy, those who are enforcing policy, those who are developing processes, the most important thing is to recognize the extent of operating change that our healthcare delivery system will have to go through to comply with the policies that we've now put in place, and simply to comply with the changes that are implied by making healthcare more available to millions of more people. Mm-hmm. And by the way, what is legislated to be at a lower cost.
Yeah,
I think we've got 10 years, if we're good at it, of operating change ahead. And so it's really important to be realistic for people inside these agencies to recognize what it's going to take, to also recognize that along the way, we can have some failures of healthcare delivery organizations, and we need those organizations in order to continue to care for our people. Mm-hmm. There'll be some hospitals that won't be able to get their costs down below what Medicare and Medicaid is going to reimburse them for. We're going to see some failures. We're going to see some breakdowns. And so I think it's important for the agencies to understand that. Mm-hmm. That doesn't mean that we should disengage from what we've set out to do. I believe that we needed the kind of certainly insurance reform that the current legislation has put in place. And I don't think there should be any going back on that. Now it's a matter of execution. Mm-hmm. And you know, for better or for worse, my experience of years of work in Washington, and this is not a criticism, but that the strength in agencies is often around policy. It's not around execution. Some agencies are better than others. The agencies that really have an operating job, particularly, are better than others. But there isn't the appreciation for execution and for operations that I would like to see in many of our agencies to really help the private sector through this, because I think the private sector is going to need a lot of help through this, and not just financial help. It's going to need really a lot of assistance, a lot of advice in how to comply.
Yeah, it's hard to tell sometimes from organized groups in the private sector what's white noise and what really is a cry for help.
Yes,
but
yes.
It does seem that the private sector healthcare providers are, I don't know if confused is the right word, but really unsure or apprehensive about how to move forward.
They're very apprehensive. I can tell you that, Francis. I get to spend time with a lot of healthcare providers in the private sector and also public healthcare providers. They're very, very apprehensive. And you know, this is a business, if you will. The business of healthcare has not changed in this country. We have a sense of entitlement around it. The costs are now near 20% of GDP. That's unsustainable. Mm-hmm. So even without, as you pointed out earlier in our discussion, the fear that this new legislation has put in place, just looking at those numbers, it was easy to see that they're unsustainable. Mm-hmm. But although we've been looking at those numbers now for a while, the industry has failed to change. So I think the apprehension is both recognition of what's coming, or in fact what's here, as well as, at least up to now, the inability of the industry of healthcare to change. You know, I had an interesting discussion with an individual physician a while back, and he said to me, you know, I run my practice just the way my father did, who was also a physician in Brooklyn. He said, my mother used to work for my father. She would sit in the front of his office and she would collect $5 and fill out a little index card every day for every visit. He says, I still collect the $5, but it's a copayment now.
Yeah.
But I still do the same thing. Uh-huh. I still do the same thing that my father did 30, 40 years ago.
Yeah.
And the delivery of care in this country has not changed.
You said it will take 10 years to do this transformation if we're good at it.
If we're good at it.
What do you think the odds are that we're good enough at it to be able to do it in 10 years?
Well, look, I actually think we are good enough at it, Francis. When I go out and really look at clinicians and clinical organizations, these are very smart people. You know, it is not a matter of lacking the intelligence. By the way, it's not a matter of lacking the money either. Mm-hmm. There's a lot of money in the so-called system of healthcare that we're spending. So it's not money. It's not skill. I think it's the will and the focus that's required of really getting the job done and sitting back and being willing to challenge some of the underlying assumptions for how healthcare has been delivered in the past. For example, we write in the book, and by the way, I didn't have any experience about this until we were doing the research for the book. We write in the book about group visits.
Mm-hmm.
You know, every time an orthopedic surgeon does a particular soldier, you know, a shoulder, you know, really surgery, it's the same surgery for 10 patients, he tells the same story to the 10 patients in the follow-up visit, you know. Mm-hmm. But there he is, 10 times, repeating the same story, handing them out the same papers, and they leave. Well, there's a practice developing in some areas of medicine where the 10 people come into a room together, mm-hmm. all right? Now, initially you look at that and say, wow, what about privacy? What about secrecy? The truth is, Francis, the people enjoy the session. They hear from others what they're going through, what the nature of their pain is, what the physician had to say.
Well, they get the feeling that I'm not the only one.
Not the only one.
Yeah.
But that's a foreign idea to the practice of medicine in the States.
Let's talk about that more when we come back from the break. My guest is Jim Champion on Federal News Radio, 1500 AM. He is co-author of the book Reengineering Healthcare, A Manifesto for Radically Rethinking Healthcare Delivery. More with Jim when In-Depth with Francis Rose continues on Federal News Radio, 1500 AM. Back on In-Depth with Francis Rose on Federal News Radio, 1500 AM. My guest is Jim Champy, Chairman Emeritus of Dell Services Consulting and co-author of the book Reengineering Healthcare, A Manifesto for Radically Rethinking Healthcare Delivery. We're talking before the break about stimulating innovation and how you do that, how you get people to think about something in the first place, as you were talking about group visits. Because for the first however long we've been providing healthcare to each other as humans, nobody thought of that before. And yet, the group therapy model in psychotherapy is extremely popular. A lot of people both giving and receiving the care like it. How do you get people to start thinking about ideas and be willing to take the risks involved? You mentioned you've got to look at some of these things.
That's right, Francis.
How do you get people, first of all, to be willing to take the risk to have an example to then bring the other people who are apprehensive about it to be able to see it in the first place?
You know, the openness to look, Francis, usually comes from the fact that the individual, in this case the clinician, is going through some pain. And I can tell you, again, from the research Harry and I did for this book, that clinicians are going through as much pain as their patients, that they're overworked. That, you know, a primary physician today works well into the night, you know, to fill out records. They're seeing more patients than they want to. They're having to deal with filing, you know, claims to dozens of different insurance companies, all who have different standard processes. Their costs are almost what their income is in some cases. So the clinician community is going through some pain, and that means that they are willing to listen. I think they're more willing to listen today than they were 10 years ago. Once they're willing to listen, I believe you actually have to take the clinician community and show them how a new way of operating, a new set of processes, how a group visit actually is working. By the way, I was talking to one of the innovators around these group visits just this week. He told me that his practice, this is a large doctor's practice in Boston that mm-hmm. is doing this kind of group visit. His practice is now receiving 2 or 3 visits a week from other group practices from other parts of the country and other hospitals to come to see how it works. By the way, they're charging for the visits.
Uh-huh.
They're charging for the visits.
Innovation becomes a profit
That's
center.
That's right. It's become a profit center. But the flow is so great, they're saying, all right, here's a way we can make some more revenue. Uh-huh. So they're charging for it. But again, I write in the book about an example of a physician leader who wanted to show some of his surgeons how work could be done fundamentally differently, and he takes them to the Mayo Clinic. He takes them from Boston to Mayo. They go out for 3 days,
mm-hmm.
And he shows them proof. Now, to the issue of resistance, you know, healthcare, as you point out, is a risky business, and you know, a physician is dealing with lives. So I have no problem with a physician being concerned about the safety and well-being of new processes and new work.
Mm-hmm.
But the good news is that my experience has been that once a physician sees the new way of doing work and that it produces better care, they will move towards it, because in the end, a physician comes to work to do no harm.
Mm-hmm.
Now, having said that, there is a model of resistance that worries me somewhat in healthcare. The physicians objecting to what we now call protocols, all right? It's very clear, and it has been clinically proven, that for treating a certain condition, a certain illness, certain protocols work much better than others. And there are hospitals that are now requiring physicians to follow a protocol. You come into an emergency room, you say, I've got chest pains.
Mm-hmm.
Here are the 20 steps to take. And there are hospitals that are saying, if you don't take those 20 steps, you must explain to the medical board in this hospital why you did not, independent of the results.
Mm-hmm.
You must explain why you did not. Now, some physicians are looking at that and saying, cookbook medicine, and they're trying to push it aside. But the reality, Francis, is we're going to move in the new delivery models to more and more protocols, because one of the great benefits of what we're in right now, and this is where technology plays, is that with the accumulation over time of the electronic healthcare record, we are finally going to be able to prove the relationship between treatment and results.
Mm-hmm.
And if I can show you 20,000 cases of folks who come into an emergency room, with chest pain, and if by following these protocols we got dramatically better results, the whole industry is going to have to follow those protocols.
Yeah.
And should follow those protocols. So I look at it and say, it's not cookbook medicine, but it's the smart thing to do.
It seems like it's science.
It's science. I mean, that's right.
It's science.
But you know what? People will kind of want to paint it and with that kind of a term. Physicians still have to look at a patient and decide what's going on. There's
mm-hmm.
still the need for diagnosis. And nobody's going to, we can't take that skill away, and we shouldn't take that skill away from physicians. But again, it's changing the nature of work.
Mm-hmm. My guest is Jim Champy on Federal News Radio, 1500 AM. He's one of the co-authors, along with Dr. Harry Greenspun, of the book Reengineering Healthcare, A Manifesto for Radically Rethinking Healthcare Delivery, on In Depth with Francis Rose on Federal News Radio, 1500 AM. I want to talk about some more about the concept of innovation and stimulating innovation when we come back from the break, Jim.
Fine.
On In Depth with Francis Rose on Federal News Radio, 1500 AM. We're back on In Depth with Francis Rose on Federal News Radio, 1500 AM. My guest for the hour is Jim Champy, who's Chairman Emeritus of Dell Services Consulting and also co-author of the book Reengineering Healthcare, A Manifesto for Radically Rethinking Healthcare Delivery. And being that this is my industry chatter series, and we talk about the relationships between government and the contracting community, one of the things that you and I were talking about during the break that I think is really fascinating, government has a rap, and I think in many cases a bad rap, for lagging behind the rest of the economy in innovation and in thinking of new ideas and then being able to deliver on them. We were talking during the break about innovation and about the basic concepts of innovation. Expand on what we were talking about the idea that standardization is kind of
sure.
the opposite of innovation, and your
yeah.
experiences
yeah.
about whether
yeah.
that's true or not.
Francis, both in healthcare and in multiple different industries and places, what I've experienced just consistently that whenever the opportunity comes for standardization, for example, just in standardization of a technology in an agency, let's say, we're going to standardize on one laptop or one kind of technology and one kind of suite of desktop capabilities, the response is almost always, well, the standardization will reduce innovation. My experience has been that absolutely the opposite is true. That by standardizing the rote, straightforward things that an organization does, it frees up the resources and the time to really do innovation. And
mm-hmm.
time after time, Francis, that's what plays out.
Mm-hmm.
In order to drive standardization, let me tell you, it's got to be driven from the top. And every time, I've seen it work, it takes an executive to say, look, we can no longer support 10 different technologies or 10 different ways of doing this. Or in a hospital, we're going to drive and require these protocols because we have scientific evidence that they work better than other treatments that we've tried.
Mm-hmm.
But someone at the top has to make that decision. And by the way, then within a period of months, and it's not longer than that, the organization adapts and sees, in fact, that that there are more resources available, the rote work is being handled, and that that innovation, I think, is given more opportunity.
Mm-hmm. It strikes me as fairly logical that if you don't have to think about certain processes or certain standards or whatever, if you're right. automating those kinds of things,
right.
it does free your mind to move to the other side of
that's
the brain
right.
to be creative,
that's right.
and that's the incubator
absolutely.
Of innovation.
And that's what technology, again, is enabling us to do, mm-hmm. and I think we're going to see more and more of that over time.
What's the low-hanging fruit innovation-wise in government, do you think?
Wow, you know...
If there is any, I mean...
Well, I'll tell you. The low-hanging fruit in government may actually be to stop doing things.
Mm-hmm.
I know that's a broad statement, but when I look at the challenge that I think government will go through in the next few years, in mm-hmm. the next year, is, of course, this issue of deficit reduction. You know, that we're going to be under tremendous pressure in government to reduce the cost of government.
Mm-hmm.
And I'm really worried about whether that can even happen incrementally.
Mm-hmm.
You know, I had some experience years ago in the reinventing government effort that Al Gore ran. And I saw some superb work being done in agencies to improve the nature of their work in kind of very localized area. You know, I saw the Air Force dramatically reduce the number of spare parts that it needed for its fleet.
Mm-hmm.
I saw the Defense Department reduce all the complexity around travel reimbursement. But, you know, you can go across government and find all kinds of great and improve all kinds of kind of local pieces of work, but it won't add up to enough.
Mm-hmm.
And I know it may not look like the traditional low-hanging fruit, but I don't think we'll be able to manage the challenge in government of deficit reduction without actually stopping some programs. Now, I don't have a point of view of what those are.
Right.
But I believe that's going to be the low-hanging fruit, just to close things down.
Mm-hmm.
I think if we try to do deficit reduction by instituting 1,000 programs across government, we won't get to where we have to be.
Mm-hmm. I think it's interesting because over the last, I would say, 6 to 12 months, I have had more federal government people who are currently inside government saying, you know what, I think we're finally to the point where it's not a matter of should we do this, would we like to do this, but we're just out of resources.
We can't afford to do it.
Yes, that's right.
We would like to be able to do it.
Right. The merits of this are very good.
That's right.
But we're maxed out.
Can't afford to do it.
Mm-hmm.
Now look, if we go far enough, and again, this is... You might say this is just being too optimistic. If we go far enough in stopping the programs that are not producing what we need to produce, that may give us in a few years some resources for the government to do the things we really want to do and the things we really should be doing as an advanced society.
Mm-hmm.
But again, I come back to do we have the will? Will we have the political will to actually stop some of these things?
Yeah.
Let me tell you, when I go get inside agencies, I find a lot of people who have the will to make changes. I have been, in all of my work inside agencies, I have been struck by the competency, the operating competency. When people inside those agencies are left on their own to do the right thing, they really do the right thing. They
mm-hmm.
see the work that isn't producing results. Nothing like going to the front line and saying, what's working, what isn't working? You had asked earlier about where does innovation come from.
Yeah.
Just go look at the dysfunction. Ask the people who are doing the work to describe the dysfunction.
And that's one thing this administration has been great about is trying to get to the front drill all the way down.
The front line will show you where the dysfunction is. You know, in healthcare, go to the patients. Go to the patient. You know, I did a radio program. It's not a competing program. It's a late night program. On this book,
mm-hmm.
went on for 2 hours with people calling in about their challenges in dealing with the complexity of the healthcare system. Just compelling stories. Listen to these people who have family members who have chronic illnesses and diseases trying to navigate through the complexity of healthcare today. And by the way, it's only going to get more complex if we don't do something. And you can start to see the opportunities for innovation. You start to see the opportunities for simplification. Go to a physician I mean, look at the physician, look at the work of a physician every day,
mm-hmm.
and you can very easily innovate, very, very easily innovate. One of the things that I found very compelling in the research for this book is the innovations are sometimes very simple, very straightforward. After the work is done, the change is done, you'd look at that and say, why didn't we think about that? Mm-hmm. Why didn't we do that?
Yeah. It's really amazing to think about the amount of time that we spend trying to think of innovation and don't go to the front lines, to the end user.
You know, sometimes we think today, by the way, innovation is inventing the next Facebook. It isn't. Innovation can be much simpler than that. We write in the book about a simple case where the orthopedic surgeons were having problems with the radiology department. The group practice just put the two departments together. They literally broke down the walls.
Mm-hmm.
And they said, look, you folks are sending memos to each other. Now you're in the same room.
Sitting next
to each other and meet every morning to talk about your workload. Mm-hmm. They fix the problem.
Yeah.
That's not rocket science.
No.
It is innovation.
It is indeed. Jim Champy, my guest, Chairman Emeritus of Dell Services Consulting and co-author of the book Reengineering Healthcare on Federal News Radio, 1500 AM. Back to wrap up our conversation in just a moment. We're back to wrap up on Federal News Radio, 1500 AM, with my guest Jim Champy, Chairman Emeritus of Dell Services Consulting. He is co-author of the book Reengineering Healthcare, a Manifesto for Radically Rethinking Healthcare Delivery, and you can find out more about it and even link through to buy yourself a copy later this afternoon at federalnewsradio.com/in-depth. You're not wasting any time, though. You're already working on another book, you said, during the break.
Working on another set of ideas. That's right.
What's this one about?
This is part of a series of books that I've been writing, Francis, looking at new business models, and mm-hmm. this is a book called Deliver. And in it, I actually get the opportunity to write about a wonderful example of what I think is brilliant execution, and Deliver is principally about execution, brilliant execution in the federal government. And I write a whole chapter dedicated to the Virginia subclass program.
Mm-hmm.
You know, several years ago, the Navy recognized that its current fleet of subs were just inadequate for the current political conditions and the current world conditions. And that needed a much more flexible boat, if you will, as they call it in the Navy. But this boat was going to cost about $3.5 billion. And as you know, the Defense Department often gets criticized for budget overruns and problems in large projects of this kind. And I must tell you that Congress made it a little even more challenging, because Congress said, look, if we're going to approve this program, we want this boat built by two shipyards. So here's a complex boat, by the way, more parts than the Boeing jetliner,
mm-hmm.
Very sophisticated, built in two separate shipyards. It has to be assembled. The parts have to be brought together and assembled, and it's got to work. Well, the Navy was successful in building the boat, not for $3.5 billion, not for $2.5 billion. They actually took it down to $2 billion, and they increased the productivity rate from one boat a year to two boats a year. Again, how did they do it?
Mm-hmm.
Operating disciplines, intelligence, operating disciplines. First, you know, I often hear the criticism that, well, in government, there isn't a profit motive. I actually think government's got a better motive that drives change and drives operations. It's the high sense of purpose. You know, the folks in the Navy and the folks at these shipyards said, look, we have no choice but the defense and protection of this country to produce a new kind of sub. That's what's at stake here. We got to do it in an affordable way. So there was this high sense of purpose that I think drove the program. Secondly, technology. Everything was digitized, mm-hmm. transparency. Everybody could see what was happening. By the way, the shipyards shared interesting financial engineering. The shipyards shared equal profits independent of the work they were doing. They shared in the profits equally. So there wasn't a fight about who was going to do what. The question was, where could we do the work best? Mm-hmm. Where could we do the work best? A team that shared this sense of purpose, that actually got the job done. And, you know, I look at an effort like that, and I say that sometimes, you know, government agencies really get a bad rap. They can execute. They can execute. And again, when you leave it to the people on the front lines,
mm-hmm.
who see and understand what's going on, who understand what it takes to build and to live with a complex ship like a submarine, you can get great results.
Jim Champy, author or co-author of the book Reengineering Healthcare, a Manifesto for Radically Rethinking Healthcare Delivery, and Chairman Emeritus of Dell Services Consulting. Would love to have you come back and talk about Deliver when it's done.
Thank you, Francis. Be pleased to do that.
You can find out more about Mr. Champy's book, co-written with Harry Greenspun, Chief Medical Officer of Dell, at federalnewsradio.com/in-depth later on this afternoon. In hour number two of the program, we'll talk about hiring diversity in the federal government. Is it getting easier or harder to bring a skilled, diverse workforce into government, with officials of the Environmental Protection Agency, Department of Homeland Security, and Office of Personnel Management? Hour number two of In Depth with Francis Rose on Federal News Radio, 1500 AM, right around the corner.